exist when everybody believes that they don't exist.
Banks like the Central Bank of Sweden, Israel, Canada, and South Korea all had to raise rates, but they were quickly forced to cut them.
The Fed and other central banks basically say, okay, fine, you issue those securities to finance this fiscal stimulus and we'll buy them. That's what this helicopter money concept amounts to.
The true unemployment rate is probably closer to 11% today when you take a look at the people that have dropped out, aren't counted. They call it the gig economy, some who are just working part-time.
If you hadn't had the aging post-war babies and people simply dropping out because they couldn't find jobs that they liked or qualified for, the unemployment rate would be 4.9%. As it's registered today, it would be about 11%.
We're in a world of historically low interest rates.
We have a situation where most people in Europe and North America have seen declines in their purchasing powers for over a decade. And in the words of that old movie Network, the guy runs to the window, opens it, and yells out, I'm mad as hell, I'm not going to take it anymore. I think that's where voters are, and they are reacting by going for the fringe politician.
This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team, Jim Poplava and John Loeffler.
Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava, and welcome to this week's special edition of the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, we are during our summer recess period, so we're not going with our regular programming format. Coming up, the author of The Age of Deleveraging and editor of Insight Magazine, A. Gary Schilling. That's coming up next.
And I'm John Loeffler. In the next hour, we'll be having Jim go on the record where we answer your emails. This is customary for us. At the end of summer, we take a 2-week recess and do special programs for 2 weeks. Of course, as our promise always is, and as we did last year, if something really major happens regarding the markets, we will be back with a special show regardless of our time off. So all of that coming up today, as Jim forecasted here on the Financial Sense News Hour.
Well, it's been a very difficult year for the markets. We started out in a downturn, but things have turned around. Will this be the same going forward, and do better days lie ahead? Joining me on the program is the author of The Age of Deleveraging and editor of Insight Magazine, A. Gary Schilling. You know, Gary, looking back at the bursting of the housing bubble and the global markets, it was clear we were in a bubble. The question I have is, why do you believe bubbles are hard to diagnose by experts? Is there a chance, for example, where we are today with interest rates at zero or negative, that central banks lead us into another crisis as the price of financial assets are bid up as they are now?
Well, that certainly is a possibility. I mean, bubbles exist when everybody believes that they don't exist. In other words, when you have this complete credibility in whatever is going on, in the case of housing in the early last decade, that it's going to go up forever, and people took all kinds of risk, both as borrowers and lenders, and subprime mortgages were triumphing. So you have that kind of an atmosphere, and people just convinced that house prices are only going to go one way. And, of course, when bubbles break is when you run out of buyers and you're left with nothing but potential sellers. And that's what happened at the end of 2006 and into 2007. As far as what's going on now, yeah, there is a potential bubble here because interest rates are obviously low in this country. They're negative in Europe and Japan and in many countries. And that has encouraged all kinds of risk-taking. When a pension fund has a target of, let's say, 7.5% return on their portfolios, and you have low interest rates and low returns on many of their traditional investments, they are tempted and encouraged to move out on the risk curve. The alternative is to cut benefits for pensioners, and that's pretty tough to do, and particularly politically. So they oftentimes simply take greater and greater risk. Recently, I think they've been moving into real estate. They've gotten discouraged with hedge funds. They performed very poorly in this expansion. They've only grown about half the rate of the S&P, and they command very high fees, so they're abandoning hedge funds, but they're looking for something else. And real estate seems to be a target now, and the risk is that whatever people rush into gets overdone, and particularly when they're encouraged to take risk in pursuit of returns that just aren't there on a risk-adjusted basis.
You know, something that we have seen here, we're in a world of historically low interest rates. In fact, the Bank of England, this is the lowest interest rate that we've seen on British gilt since its founding in 1694. As far as I know, Gary, maybe I'm wrong, we've never been in a world where we actually have negative interest rates and we have actual real zero coupon bonds. In other words, if you buy them, the rate of return is actually negative or zero. So are we in danger of a bond market bubble?
Well, that's a good question. I think you need to look at it not in terms of nominal rates, but in real rates. In other words, interest rates corrected for inflation. In that sense, they have been negative repeatedly throughout history. In this country, for example, when inflation was raging, in the 1970s, interest rates were negative. In other words, interest rates were high, but not as high as inflation. So if you subtract inflation, the numbers were negative. And that's been true in many other countries over the centuries. So the situation is different now because you have not only low nominal rates, but you have low inflation and deflation in a number of cases, which is creating these negative real rates. I don't know what's going to come out of this, Jim. I think when we get enough perspective and look back on this in a year or so, whatever time it takes, we're going to find that this whole situation with negative nominal interest rates and with very aggressive monetary policy, which has not done much to spur economic growth, and all the confusion it's created, you know, my theory has been, and I wrote about this in our newsletter Insight in March of last year, that we have a situation where most people in Europe and North America have seen declines in their purchasing powers for over a decade. And in the words of that old movie Network, the guy runs to the window, opens it, and yells out, "I'm mad as hell, I'm not going to take it anymore." I think that's where voters are. And they are reacting by going for the fringe politicians. They've abandoned the center. They say these guys aren't delivering the goods. So they go for things like the National Front in France, very far right. They go for Trudeau in Canada, new prime minister, very much on the left. And in this country, of course, we have Bernie Sanders, an avowed socialist, and Trump, who's very much a protectionist. So we're getting these extremes in a lot of ways. I think the basic cause of this is globalization, movement of manufacturing, other production out of Europe and North America to China and other developing countries in the last 30 years. It's really the root of all this. But the point is, it has created tremendous distortions. And I wish we could pull out the crystal ball and find out what is going to come out of this. But I rather suspect it may not be pretty when we get all through.
This reminds me, I've read all of your books, and many decades ago, you made a very prescient call that we would hit 3% interest rates. At the time you did that, everybody thought you were kind of crazy. That forecast came to fruition. Recently, we saw the 10-year note get down to 1.36. Your latest forecast is that rates could fall as low as 1%. Do you still hold that view? And what would be the driver?
Yes, I do. There's several factors. One is that we are in deflation, low inflation, and actual declining price indices. I mean, for example, if you look at the CPI, which was just reported for July, and year over year, it was up 0.9%. But if you subtract what I think is kind of a phony number, and it assumes that everybody rents their house from themselves, and because rents have been going up, people haven't been able to buy houses they've been renting. But if you take off this assumption that you rent your house from yourself, which is about 25% of the index, the year over change is 0.1%, basically flat. And in many countries, we have actual deflation in these major price indices. So deflation is one factor. Another factor is the safe haven aspect of treasuries. They're among the best credits in the world. And then there are other factors that banks, other financial institutions are required to hold government securities. And it may sound kind of ridiculous. Why not hold cash if you have negative rates and you don't lose anything on it? But the rules are the rules, and when they have to hold government securities, even if they're paying for the privilege, that's another further inducement. And of course, if interest rates are negative, they can get more negative, and that means prices of the underlying securities go up. And I've always been interested in treasuries for appreciation. I don't care what the yield is as long as it's going down. But you have this confluence of factors, deflation and safe haven the principal ones that I think are driving treasuries. And I look for 1% on the 10-year yield and 2% on the 30-year.
You know, this is something I want you to just spend a moment and explain to our listeners, because, you know, a lot of investors would look at treasuries today, the 10-year note a little over 1.5%. Why would I invest in 1.5? You've always explained that one of the reasons you own treasuries and the kind of treasuries you own are for capital appreciation. Explain the difference in what would it mean, for example, if rates, which were at 2%, at the beginning of the year, got down to 1%, what that would mean in terms of capital appreciation.
Yeah, well, let's use the parallel with stocks. The dividend payment on the S&P 500 divided by the price of the index is about 2%. Now, I don't think there are a lot of people who would buy the S&P for 2%, and that yield is not changed appreciably in recent years. Why do people buy stocks? Yeah, sure, they like to have yield, but they basically are looking for appreciation. They're looking for capital gains, not, in effect, dividend income. And the same is true, as far as I'm concerned, for treasuries. As I mentioned earlier, I don't care less what the yield is as long as it's going down, because if the yield goes down, the price goes up. For example, if you look at right now, if you have a further decline in yields on the 10-year treasury note to 1%, you know, you'll have about 8% total return. The coupon, the interest payment plus the appreciation. In contrast, if you had a 30-year zero coupon bond that doesn't pay a precise dividend, but they're issued at a discount, and in effect the interest payment is the appreciation as they move toward maturity and are paid off at 100 at par. If you have that today, you would make about 15% on your money. If I'm right, and we go from where we are around 2.6% down to 2% on a 30-year. So it's largely the appreciation, which is the driver. And as they say, I don't know why people look at bonds entirely differently than stocks. I mean, they say, oh, well, you know, if you hold it to maturity, all you get is this 1.5% on the 10-year. Well, what's the maturity on stocks? There is no maturity. Unless the stock is called or the company goes bust, it theoretically lasts forever. So to sort of say, you got to hold bonds to maturity, but if you say, I hold stocks to maturity, well, that's infinity. And I don't think many of us are going to be around for infinity.
Speaking of interest rates, the markets, we've spent a large part of this year focused on rate hikes by the Fed. In fact, the latest Fed minutes implied that they were going to go again, with probabilities rising for December. Recently, the Bank of England cut rates to 0.25%. In your recent letter, you believe the Fed's next move will be to reduce rates. What does that say about our economy and monetary policy if all the Fed was able to do this cycle was raise interest rates 0.25%?
Well, for one thing, it says the Fed has had a very poor record in forecasting. Throughout this expansion, they've been constantly overestimating economic growth, overestimating inflation, and saying as a result that they were always going to raise rates, you know, 6 months down the road. And yeah, they finally did go up 0.25% last December, but I think that's because they've been crying wolf so often that they needed to do something to maintain any credibility at all. But their forecasting record has been abysmal. And if I were in their shoes, frankly, I'd just say, hey, we're not good at this. Let's not bother. And the Fed used to not forecast the so-called forward guidance, where they tell everybody what they're going to do. But what they're going to do is driven by the data, which is not yet available. And they're just not very good at forecasting that data. They're very poor at forecasting it, as the record of the last 7 years, 8 years has shown. So I think you do have that fundamental problem to start with. But I just think that the reason that the Fed may very well cut rates before they raise them is because of global economic weakness. The British decision to leave the European Union, Brexit, certainly adds to that. I think we're pretty much for sure have a recession locked in the UK and spreads to the continent of Europe. And you mentioned the aggressive monetary actions the Bank of England has taken. They cut rates. They've gone back to quantitative easing, buying government securities. They're making loans available to business at very, very attractive rates. And, you know, I think that with all that that's happening, that the world is in a very slow growth and getting slower. And again, as mentioned earlier, we don't have any inflation. You know, CPI, when you look at it realistically, it's gone nowhere in the last year. It's been up only 0.1%. So this is an atmosphere which I think is much more conducive to reducing rates as opposed to raising them.
You know, it's interesting because, you know, the fact that you believe they could end up cutting next, and we've seen this happen a number of times since the financial crisis, where you've had banks like the Central Bank of Sweden, Israel, Canada, and South Korea. They all raised rates, but they were quickly forced to cut them. Do you think one of the issues, as you mentioned about forecasting, one of the problems at the Fed is most of these people are academics? They haven't worked in the real economy, or they haven't been on a trade desk at an investment bank somewhere. So they operate with a lot of these models that theoretically tell them how things should work, and oftentimes they don't.
Yeah, well, that's absolutely true. I've challenged a number of these key central bankers over the years, and they're bright people. They're not stupid, but I've pointed out that almost none of them have ever met a payroll. They've never really been in what I would call the real economy. They've been either in academia or within the Federal Reserve System. Yellen's basically spent her whole career in government and the Fed. No exposure to the private economy that I'm aware of. So I think these people are just fundamentally out of touch with what's going on.
You know, policy experts have been wrong. But Gary, when you're wrong so many times, I know in the investment world, you can come up with a thesis, or you can say, I think this is going to happen. I think we ought to buy this stock. The earnings don't turn out. The company plan doesn't turn out. And you reevaluate and make changes. Why do you think they persist on doing the same thing?
You know, I really don't know. And because fundamentally, they don't have to. In other words, this whole idea of forward guidance telling what their forecasts are is relatively recent. Now, you know, my theory, for what it's worth, is that we are in this age of transparency. Coming out of the Great Recession, it was revealed that there was so much that was under the table in terms of bad loans and subprime mortgages and so on, and all the congressional hearings and scapegoats that were being searched for and so on, that we went the other way into the transparency end of the spectrum. Well, these people have said they're mere mortals, and I think they got dragged along, and they said, well, transparency is the end thing, so we ought to be transparent. So that was the idea of telling the markets, telling investors what they plan to do under this set of circumstances if this data vow. Well, again, as we mentioned a couple of minutes ago, they've been very, very poor at forecasting that data. But they don't need to do that, and they did not do that until recently. And as a matter of fact, we did a little study looking at the volatility of stocks and bonds in the last year and comparing that with a period back in the 1990s, 1994 to be precise, when the Fed raised rates from 3% to 6% in the space of 7 months. And it was a very traumatic time. And there was no forward guidance then. They gave no indication ahead of time. They did it out of the blue. And yet the volatility in stocks and bonds back then was less than it has been in the last year when they have been trying to tell people what they're going to do. So the combination of their poor forecasting record and the evidence that it certainly hasn't improved the situation, hasn't reduced volatility. If I were in their shoes, I'd say, look, let's just skip this. Let's go back to where we were and not say anything and announce our decisions and let the chips fall where they may.
You know, one thing that you pointed out in a recent Insight newsletter, they could be making a big mistake in terms of looking at the drop in employment rate. As you talk about, it had much to do with people dropping out of the labor force. And you believe that the true unemployment rate is probably closer to 11% today when you take a look at the people that have dropped out, aren't counted, or in many ways, in this economy, they call it the gig economy, some who are just working part-time.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. If you look at the unemployment rate, it is the ratio of people who are actively looking for work to the denominator is the labor force, which are those people plus the people that are employed. Now, the unemployment rate comes down as a result if you don't have as many people looking for work. It isn't necessarily because the employed number is going up. You simply have dropouts from the labor force. And that's what's happened really since February of 2000. You've had a big decline in what's called the labor participation rate. This is the percentage of people 16 or over who are either working or actively looking for work. Now, that's declined for two reasons. One is the aging post-war babies. They simply, in effect, drop out as they retire. And that accounts for about 60% of that decline. But the other 40% is accounted for by people who have gotten discouraged. They couldn't find jobs that they wanted or were qualified for. And it's also a lot of younger people who thought if they stayed in school longer, they'd accumulate more education, have a better shot at good jobs. Unfortunately, a lot of them didn't have any better job prospects when they came out, but acquired an awful lot of student debts. But the point is that if you hadn't had those big dropouts, one demographic, the aging post-war babies, and the other one, people simply dropping out because they couldn't find jobs that they liked or qualified for. If you didn't have that, the unemployment rate wouldn't be 4.9% as it's registered today. It would be about 11%.
One thing that you have pointed out in, you know, for investors here who are looking at yields that have been next to nothing for almost 7 or 8 years, it's actually worse overseas. And as you talked about, one of the reasons the Fed may end up cutting interest rates or things are so dismal overseas. And what happens, Gary, we've seen it in Brexit. We've seen it in other crises over the last 5 or 6 years. Anytime there's a crisis, or if you look at the European bond market today, where much of the debt is negative, money flocks to our market because we do have the largest economy in the world. We have the largest financial market in the world. Our market is broad in its depth. It's very liquid. And treasuries are non-callable, unlike many corporate bonds.
Yeah, that in itself is an interesting point, because when you look at bonds, corporate bonds, a lot of times they're callable, which means that they can be called back by the issuing corporation that pays usually par. Now, let's say a corporate bond was issued at 6% at par. Well, if the yield is now, let's say, 4%, it's selling at a premium. It's selling above 100 because the price goes up as the yield goes down. But the company can call that at 100, and that's going to limit the capital appreciation. And so the unfortunate reality is that when rates are going down, and you wish you had longer maturities, because the longer maturity you have, the more appreciation you get for a given decline in interest rates. When you have that situation, rates are going down, you're limited by that call. The company simply calls them in and limits your appreciation. And conversely, I mean, this is insidious on both ends, because if rates go up, the company isn't going to call a bond because they'd have to reissue it at a higher rate. It would cost them more money. So it really says that you end up with a longer maturity when rates are going up, and you wish you had a shorter maturity when rates are going down, and you want the longest maturity. In effect, the call feature shortens it. So corporate bonds and other bonds with call features are just not very good instruments when rates are rising, when rates are falling. But a lot of them have it, and a lot of investors buy them because the yields tend to be higher than those on treasuries.
Are we running into an issue now where we have global quantitative easing? We saw the Fed expand its balance sheet by over $4 trillion. The Bank of England's doing the same. The ECB's doing the same. Japan is doing the same. Where they vacuum up a vast quantity of sovereign debt, creating shortages for institutional investors. I mean, recently, the ECB and the Bank of England have expanded to corporate debt, having difficulty buying other sovereign issues.
Yeah, that's true. And, of course, what's happened is the European Central Bank has expanded the list of things it'll buy. Now, part of that is to try to, in effect, spread the effects to corporate bond markets. But it also is because of the shortage of the government debt they can buy. And they're limited because some of the government debt in Europe, like in Greece, is in trouble. And they are limited on buying sovereign debt that is not too sovereign. That's not the case in England, but it does mean there are shortages of issues that they can buy. And, you know, but the reality is that this quantitative easing, this doesn't do much to spur the economy. And I think the reason is pretty obvious. When a central bank goes out and buys securities like the Fed did earlier, they just continue that program at the end of 2014. But they buy securities. Okay. Now what happens? If they buy them, the money gets reinvested, and a lot of it went into stocks. And I think that's why we've had this strong stock rally starting in March of 2009. But then what happens is the stock price goes up. Does that affect spending on goods and services? No, not much. Because if the stocks are bought and the appreciation is realized by financial institutions, pension funds, endowment funds, and so on, they don't change the number of people they hire or what they spend on food or whatever other rent or whatever. They don't change that much in relation to their portfolios. And if stock appreciation is held by individuals, most stocks are held by high-income individuals, and they don't tend to adjust their spending much as their portfolios go up and down. In other words, if some guy's got four cars in the driveway, he probably doesn't have room for a fifth anyway, even though he may have an increase in his portfolio. He just doesn't have any use for that extra money. So central bank quantitative easing has done almost nothing to spur the economy. Now, what's interesting now is the latest wrinkle on this is this so-called helicopter money. And that is a combination of quantitative easing, if you will, and fiscal stimulus. And that's a different kind of animal. That's the idea that governments issue a lot of debt because they're going to spend on infrastructure, roads, schools, bridges, and I think that's likely to happen, or military spending, particularly Republicans control Washington. They'd be more interested in military spending than the Democrats. But if you have that, and then the Fed and other central banks basically say, okay, fine, you issue those securities to finance this fiscal stimulus and we'll buy them. That's what this helicopter money concept amounts to. It's kind of a variation on quantitative easing, but it is linked to fiscal stimulus, and that's not been the case. The fiscal stimulus was really in 2009, and the U.S. have gone the other way until recently on that, so that would be a change.
Given the fact that they're now talking about helicopter money in this presidential campaign, neither candidate, unlike the 2012 election, is talking about fiscal austerity, the sequester, and what we were doing back then. They're both talking about spending money, whether it's infrastructure or the military. Have we reached a point, Gary, where the policies of the central bank are basically doing more harm? And what I mean by that, look what they've done to bank profit margins. And also look what they're doing to consumers. Consumers aren't earning anything on savings, and yet they're increasing saving because they're getting no return elsewhere. So they're encouraged to save more.
Yeah, it has been very disruptive, and the central banks are well aware of that. In a sense, they've got a tiger with a tail they don't know how to let go. But yeah, it is true that central banks are limited in what they can do to spur the economy. They can buy and sell securities. They can raise and lower interest rates, and that's it. There's nothing they can do directly. They hope that if they pump more money out with quantitative easing or make it cheaper with lower interest rates, that the markets will then take that money and turn it into loans and spending on consumer goods, capital equipment, and so on. But the markets have to do that, and the markets have not. It's very different than fiscal policy. For example, with fiscal policy, if you want to employ more people in the construction industry, you start a road project, and you're paying those people to build the road, and they go out and spend the money. So fiscal policy can be much more effective and much more direct. If you want to help the unemployed, increase unemployment benefits. Can be pinpointed and much more effective than monetary policy. You know, there's the old statement, pushing on a string. Monetary policy is effective when they tighten. That's pulling on the string. But how much effect you get when you're trying to push on the string? It goes limp and nothing happens.
I want to come back to your book that you wrote, In the Age of Deleveraging. Originally, Gary, you thought that maybe this process would last a full decade. We're probably 8 years into it. Recently, you've extended that forecast and believe it could last a good deal longer, perhaps the end of this decade. What has caused you to extend that projection?
Well, simply the slowness with which excess debt built up in the 80s and 90s has been worked down. I mean, there has been some net working down of debt in the two sectors where it ran up. One was U.S. consumers, and the other was the financial sector on a global basis. But if you simply put a ruler on the lines of working off that debt, the declines in debt, and project it out and say, when do you get back to the previous norms, it's more like 6 or 8 years from now. And that's obviously would extend it well beyond the normal decade. But that decade, and let me say this decade was really an average developed by some academic economists, Reinhardt and Rogoff, you're familiar with. And they were taking a lot of corrections after huge leveraging up periods, the deleveraging process, and they looked at a number of examples over literally centuries. They're looking at developed countries, banana republics. It was a lot of oranges and apples and kumquats and peaches, and they came up with an average of about 10 years. Now, I used that number back in that book I wrote in 2010 because that was about all you had to go on, and rough guess at that, but I'm saying there's nothing really engraved in stone about that, and so far, it's going to take longer. Now, what could cut short this process, as I mentioned earlier, would be massive fiscal stimulus. In other words, if because of this voters being mad as hell, we saw, and I think we will see this, politicians in this country, in Europe, and we're seeing it in Japan as well, get very aggressive on fiscal policy, financed by more central bank money, helicopter money, then I think we could see a shortening of this whole slow growth process. But in that book, I forecast 2% real GDP growth until the process was over. And guess what? So far in this expansion, it's averaged 2.1%, almost exactly what I forecast. And unless something happens to disrupt that, either the whole process is completed, or I think more likely before that we get big fiscal stimuli, we'll have that slow growth.
Is there a risk, Gary, now of debt growing faster than economic growth? And if that is a risk, is there a possibility government either attempts to, let's say, inflate or devalue the currency?
There's always the charge that governments use inflation to reduce the value of debt. And there's no question that in some hyperinflationary periods, that happens. Germany, after World War I, they were stuck with huge reparations. They literally unbolted factory machinery in Germany and carted it off in rail cars to France and so on. And they used inflation as a way of, in effect, deflating the value of their debts. That's a very rare occurrence, particularly in developed countries. Banana republics, Bangladesh, you know, those countries, they do it all the time. That goes with the territory. But I think that for responsible countries, and particularly today, to try to use inflation to get rid of the value of debt, they just don't think that way. And thank goodness they don't. The other valid point, though, is that the low interest rates today have greatly reduced the cost of government debt. Because obviously, if you're talking about federal government debt, the financing cost of about 2% on average, this is a lot lower than it was earlier at 6 or 8%. So it means that even the rise in debt in recent years has meant lower financing costs, if you measure it in relation to GDP, for example. So it does give them a lot of leeway. We've looked at this whole issue of the so-called debt bomb, because here's the argument, that government debt gets so big that the interest on that debt becomes a huge deficit item itself. In other words, the annual shortfall between revenues and expenditures is greatly augmented by the need to pay interest on that debt year after year. And that means with a big deficit, you're adding more to debt, and the whole thing takes off geometrically. The reality is that to get back to the greatest ratio of government interest payments to GDP that we've ever had in the post-war period, and that was back in the 70s, you'd have to have the interest rates on federal debt go from about 2% to what was back then 8.5%. And that in itself didn't upset the apple cart, but that would be a huge increase in interest rates. And if that happened, I think there'd be a lot more important things we'd have to worry about.
Yeah, this brings up an issue, because I was looking at the interest that the government paid on its debt last year, and it was somewhere in the neighborhood of $430 billion. That was $20 billion less than what they paid in 2008 when we had $8 to $9 trillion less debt.
Right. Well, that's exactly my point.
Is there a problem here? Because I think the average yield on all of government debt is a little over 2%. So if you take $20 trillion of debt, add a 1% increase, Gary, there's $200 billion of additional interest.
Oh, sure. And a forerunner of that is what happened in World War II, because there was this, what was called the Accord. That was sort of a jargon at the time, but that was the agreement between the Treasury and the Fed, the central bank, to hold down interest rates to make it cheap to finance all the government debt that was issued to finance World War II. And then finally, in 1951, they had this accord where they said, okay, we're not going to, in effect, peg interest rates anymore. And interest rates then rose from there until 1980. And of course, inflation was picking up and pushing them up as well. But part of it was simply coming off this, in effect, pegged interest rates to make it cheap to finance government debt. So this has happened in the past. It's not unique. And, you know, the suggestion that central banks are truly independent, they tend to be in peacetime, but in wartime, they're in there financing the government. And right now, we're not in a shooting war of the size of World War II, but we are in a war against slow economic growth.
I want to move on to the political cycle, because as you mentioned, at least in my career, Gary, it's a political cycle unlike anything I've seen, where you have growing populism, not only just here, but around the globe. You've got anti-trade in both candidates here and globally, and the candidates are proposing large fiscal spending and concomitant deficits. Everyone has turned sort of Keynesian in many ways. Will this be any more effective in righting the economy? And what happens if the world resorts to, let's say, protectionism like it did in the 30s?
Yeah, that's a good point, because whatever they do in terms of fiscal stimuli could very well be offset, at least partially, by protectionism. Protectionism has been growing. I mean, it's epitomized by Trump here, by the National Front in France, by far-right and far-left parties in Europe. It's nothing new, but protectionism is just a state of affairs when there's slow economic growth, and particularly with globalization, which I think has been the biggest global economic force in the last 30 years, the shifting of manufacturing and other production from Europe and North America to China and other developing countries. That's been extremely disruptive, and the tendency is to say, okay, we're going to blame the growth on foreign imports. We're going to blame it on immigrants, and protectionism obviously flourishes under those circumstances. So protectionism is nothing new. There hasn't been a major global free trade agreement that amounted to anything for over a decade. This Doha round, which I think is about 10 years ago, it's gone nowhere. That was designed to cut tariffs further and ease up on, you know, the usual array of safety and health regulations, which really amount to protectionism in many cases.
You know, you have made, over the years that I've been following you, several prescient calls throughout your career. You talk about two fundamental principles that kind of drive your forecast. And one is history is relevant because, as we've seen, human nature doesn't change. In fact, we have behavioral finance now that tries to study that. And secondly, your forecast must be non-consensus. So I take it if, you know, everybody is feeling in a certain direction, that raises a little bit of caution on your side.
Well, it does, because I don't think I can add any value to our newsletter subscribers, to our clients for whom we manage money, to the financial institutions that we consult with. I don't think we can add any value by rehashing the consensus. The consensus is pretty well built into security markets. To use the Wall Street term, it's fully discounted. So I think you need to look for what's strange, rare, new, and exotic. In other words, I'm looking for things that have three characteristics. One is that they're important. They're not trivial, not something that's going to be revised out in the next month's data. Secondly, that they have a good chance of happening. And ultimately, you're judged by your forecasting record. So it's you want to pick things that do have a high probability, at least in your view, are going to happen. And third, are not yet within the purview of the consensus. And I say not yet because you hope that they do evolve as you forecast and that the consensus will be forced to come around to them. So those are the criteria that I go by. Now, this is a different approach than what is normally defined as contrarian. A contrarian is somebody who is always against the consensus regardless. If I agree with the consensus, I just pass over it lightly. No point spend a lot of time on it. Everybody knows it. But it's where I find things that are important, have a good chance of happening, and are not yet perceived by the consensus. Those are the things that I jump on with all fours. Those are the things that I think are important and are going to help us add value to our clients.
You know, you talk about deflation over the years. Gary, what role does technology play in making your forecast? I mean, we've seen how the internet has changed commerce. Retail stores are closing. We've seen this announcements from Macy's, Nordstrom's, and even Walmart is going to smaller stores. Social media changed advertising. There's a lot of disruptive forces in what you call, I guess, good deflation versus bad deflation.
Yeah, well, that's true. And this whole phenomenon of the internet online buying has had a tremendous impact. Another one, of course, is the shift away from print media to people reading their news online or getting it, you know, streamed or TV or whatever, because that greatly reduces the ad revenues in the media business. But you talk about retailing. We had a number of years ago, a client came to us and he had the idea that the online buying was going to be the death of the major department stores. And because they often are the anchors in malls, in other words, they're on either end, and it's the smaller stores filling in between them that in effect exist because people come to the Macy's or the Nordstrom's or whatever, and they visit these smaller stores at the same time, that the whole malls would die and the real estate around them would be in trouble. And I thought this guy was really extreme, but we looked at it, did a major study for them, and you know, it did seem to have a lot of merit. And of course, that's exactly what's been happening. As you see that as people buy online, you know, they call up Amazon, I do it, you do it, you get free shipping. You can order almost anything you want, and you don't have to go around visiting umpteen stores to find it, and then they're out of stock. You get it, it's there. And of course, it's a way that retailers can get exposure on a widespread basis without having a huge bricks and mortar presence. So these things are very deflationary, and they're having a big effect. And of course, they're having some adverse effects on the people who are in the old order, if you will, but very favorable effects to those who are taking advantage of them, including consumers.
You know, one of the things that you can say about whether you want to call it the new normal, it's been a very difficult market to navigate for a lot of investors, both the individual and professional, the last 7 to 8 years. Your latest newsletter talks about a number of investment themes, long treasuries, long the dollar, short everything else. Explain your views, because that really narrows your choices. And why not high dividend paying stocks or other sectors of asset classes?
Well, we do have high dividend paying stocks that we use in our portfolios. We manage things like utilities, healthcare, consumer staples. These are things that tend to have high dividends, and they also are things that people are going to buy in good times and bad. And those two characteristics have driven us to use these over the last 3 or 4 years at least. And they have actually outperformed the bulk of stocks during that period. Now, we weren't looking for superior performance. I'm glad to have it, but it was really those two characteristics that they're defensive. They're things that are going to hold up in any economic conditions better than others, and they also do have high dividend yields, which give you a fair amount of protection.
In just another couple of weeks, the markets will start to get focused on the election candidates, and obviously we're looking at two candidates with different philosophies in terms of what they want to do. Have you looked at their policies, and what do you think would be the impact on the markets of either candidate, if I may ask?
Well, I think the more interesting one is Trump, and I made the argument, again, we had a short article and recent insight on this, that if Trump were elected, that the U.S. dollar and treasuries would probably rally. Stocks might sell off, but treasuries and the dollar rally. Now, why is that? That sounds contradictory. Well, it's simply this, that Trump is such an unknown, he's so unpredictable, he's really said a lot of off-the-wall kinds of things, and I think he would scare a lot of foreigners. You know, Machiavelli said, it's better to be feared than to be loved. Because people can fall out of love with you, but if they fear you, that'll probably persist. And I think that that would create a lot of anxiety. And where do people go when they're really concerned? They go to the safe havens. And what are the safe havens? The U.S. dollar and treasuries. Those are the ultimate safe havens. So ironically, I think Trump would probably be beneficial for the dollar and treasuries. Now, Hillary, that's kind of more of the same. I mean, she's been pushed even further to the left by Bernie. And, you know, she is talking about higher taxes on upper income people and more income redistribution, more money pumped into education. Although, you know, the evidence is that it has not improved the quality of education. And a lot of times all that happens is that people get higher student loans and so college tuitions go up. I just say, that money is ours, we'll take it. But those are her programs. And, of course, Bernie was pushing for basically Medicare for everybody, free college tuition, and Hillary has moved in those directions. And I don't know that that would be necessarily terribly disruptive to the markets, but I think they would tend to further push us in the direction of Europe, which is much more socialistic, much less entrepreneurial, much less free enterprise oriented. And the result, I think, has been predictably slower growth.
So given the world that we face today, some of the uncertainties not only on the political side, but also regarding central bank policy and not probably the greatest economic growth, what does an average investor do?
Well, I can tell you that we hold an extraordinary amount of cash in portfolios we manage simply because I just think there's a lot of uncertainty out there. I mentioned earlier in the interview, I don't know what's really going on here, but I think that the combination of negative interest rates in a lot of parts of the world and zeal for yield moving out on the risk curve and, you know, slow growth and the effects of Brexit, do we have a further decline to the $10 to $20 barrel price that I've been forecasting. All these things, I think, mean that there's a lot of uncertainty there. And in a time of uncertainty, my feeling is that a lot of cash is a very handy thing. Beyond that, I think portfolios ought to be defensive. Stocks are expensive. If you look at them in terms of price earnings ratios, they're very, very high. And also the earnings have not been solidly based on revenue growth. They've been based on cost cutting. And that cost cutting seems to have run out in the last couple of years. Productivity growth has been minimal, miserable, actually. So the ability of businesses to cut costs as a way to improving profit margins just hasn't worked for a couple of years. And we've seen, of course, revenues growing more slowly than profits when this was working. So I think stocks are expensive in relation to earnings, and the earnings are questionable. So I find it difficult to get excited about stocks.
Well, listen, Gary, as we close, give our listeners a brief mention on the book Age of Deleveraging, which I found fascinating. You wrote that in 2010, and much of what you wrote in that book has come out, and also your latest newsletter, Insight.
That book is still available. It's called The Age of Deleveraging: Investment Strategies for a Decade of Slow Growth and Deflation. And it's 500 pages, but I think if anybody is seriously interested in at least our views of the world, that they might want to pick up a copy. Also, our monthly newsletter, Insight, if anyone's interested in that, we can send them a complimentary copy. They can either go to our website, www.agaryschilling.com, or we do have a toll-free number, 1-888-346-7444. 888-346-7444.
Gary, well, listen, as always, it's a pleasure speaking with you. I hope you'll come back again. And I just want to say, I always enjoy reading your monthly newsletter. They're always fascinating. And you always point out things that other people aren't thinking about. So keep up the great work.
I appreciate your saying so, Jim. We've had a lot of excellent interviews over the years, and you're about the best in the business. And it's a pleasure to talk to you as usual.
Well, listen, have a great rest of the summer and take care, my friend.
Okay, bye.
That concludes my interview with A. Gary Schilling. And once again, if you haven't read his book, The Age of Deleveraging, it's one of my favorites. I remember reading it. It is 500 pages. But if you want to understand pretty much what we've seen transpire over the last 7-8 years, this is a good starting point. I've been following his work. He had a great influence on me early on in my career. When I got in the business in 1980, we were coming out of 14% inflation rates. Oil had hit $40 a barrel, and we had $800 gold and $50 silver. And here's this guy writing about a drop in interest rates of going down to 3%. Now, remember, 1982, interest rates on treasuries were 15.5%. And he talked about the bond market and what was coming and this disinflationary trend. And it had a great influence in terms of my own career, in terms of what we were doing. I did a lot of bond work in the 80s with my clients because I subscribed to the view that interest rates were coming down. So it's a great place to start. Also, he gave an offer if you want to try a free sample of his newsletter. I always enjoy reading it.
Coming up next, Jim Poplava goes on the record as he answers many of your emails as the Financial Sense News Hour continues at financialsense.com.